Right now, we are joined by one of our fellow rappeteers. Appears on our program every once in a while. That is Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Men Lawyer. Hey, Kevin, how's it going today?
Doing well.
Good to have you back on the program. Lots going on at the Minnesota State Legislature. Lots to cover today. So let's talk about one of the big stories, and that is the marijuana legalization hearing we're getting in the state Senate, which people who are pro-legalization probably are optimistic about, being that, well, there actually is going to be and has been a hearing in the state Senate, which is controlled by Republicans. Now, it looks like one of the main focuses of that hearing was actually decriminalizing marijuana. So in the bill right now, it looks like nearly 70,000 Minnesotans would have low-level marijuana convictions on their record cleared under this bill. Can you tell us what else is in this Senate bill in terms of decriminalizing marijuana?
Well, it's more about, this is about regulating cultivation, production, sale, consumption. This is really about recreational use. There is a provision in there for expungements. There would have been a provision to expunge records. But it really is more about recreational use than decriminalization. Decriminalization is sort of part of the picture, but it's a big, wide-ranging bill. But what it comes down to is regulating the use of cannabis by people 21 years of age and older in the state of Minnesota for recreational use.
Interesting. So it was more on the recreational use of marijuana.
Yeah.
Obviously, we probably
this is Franson's bill.
So I'm guessing we probably had lots of groups in there giving testimony being pro-legalization of marijuana. But I want to focus on who were some of the groups and the people that were actually testifying against legalizing marijuana in Minnesota? And what types of arguments were they making?
You had Ed Ellinger, who's a former Department of Health commissioner. You had Ken Winters, who's a Oregon Research Institute guy, Department of Psychology at the U of M, some police, Sheriff's Association folks, a mom whose kid was killed by an intoxicated driver, although I looked at the story on that, and he actually had a 0.018 blood alcohol content as well as marijuana in his system that night. So that might obviously have been a factor as well. There's a national group called SAMMIN. I don't even know what that stands for, but they're basically an advocacy group that's trying to push back against the tide of legalization in America.
What types of arguments were they making against legalization, and were any of these being challenged by some of the members of the state Senate, since, at least looking at other reports, a lot of times these claims that they make can sometimes be either distorted or flat out wrong? What sorts of responses did they make, and what were some of the arguments they made?
Well, really the way this flowed, there wasn't a lot of arguing back and forth. People just gave their points of view, and then there were questions after, but they were mostly questions between members of the body. Nobody was really challenging what anybody said, although there was a comment that from Senator Franzen that it would be good to study this further. In fact, we can talk a little bit about what they actually tried to do. They tried to get a task force going to study this, but that was killed off. Basically, people were talking about, the police department folks were saying that traffic fatalities have risen in Colorado. That was refuted by proponents. There were people talking about how, Ed Ellinger was saying that marijuana use can be associated with more mental health conditions. He said that has a bigger impact on grade point average than alcohol, stuff like that. There was a lot of different kinds of arguments for and against. It was a pretty interesting conversation. Although there was, what you did hear in terms of feedback was grumbling and snickering from people in the crowd, but it never really got to a point where anybody was shouting out. It was pretty well managed, pretty well controlled, and a pretty intelligent conversation. But I think I'm with everybody else. It's really hard to separate what's true and what's not. Everybody's throwing statistics at you, and what's true, what's not. It's very hard to know.
So what's your read on the state Senate right now in terms of maybe getting this legalized? Did any of these hearings, any of the things said during the hearings, do you think it swayed any votes? I know there are a few Republicans who are maybe leaning towards marijuana legalization, but on the other hand, there are some Democrats who are also not so sure about it. What's your read on the situation right now after today's hearings?
Well, I think in a sense we buried the lead because this bill is dead.
Mm-hmm.
It lost 6-3 in the committee, and that's kind of what I was getting at. There were amendments at the end to try to do things like, for instance, Ron Latz had a motion. What he wanted to do was have the committee approve it without recommendation, send it on to the Health and Human Services Committee just to keep the conversation going, mm-hmm. have more senators discuss it, more debate. That was rejected. He then tried to have a motion to, okay, let's form a task force that would include all kinds of stakeholders, experts, people from the mental health, from the medical community, from police, from all of the different stakeholders. That was killed. And then the bill itself died 6-3. And Latz and Senator Franzen afterwards both pointedly said that the whole reason this thing came to the committee and came to a vote was to kill it. This was about killing this bill for this year. Because it's dead in the Senate, and if it's dead in the Senate, they can still go through the motions in the House. They could pass the bill. They could put it on the floor. But without a Senate companion, and we now know the Senate companion is dead, this legislation is dead.
Yeah, so even though people might see, I mean, I was one of those people who was excited originally saying, well, hey, it's at least getting a hearing in the Senate. Maybe it's got a shot at passing. But as you said, this was more about trying to bury this legislation and make sure it doesn't come up again by voting it down, correct?
Yes, but there may be still, at least if this is your thinking on it, there may still be some reason to be excited. I mean, there was a debate. There was a conversation. This is the first time that, at least since I've been covering the Capitol full-time, and that's only been since 2017, but this is the first time I've seen a full-fledged debate. And, you know, that stuff's going to carry forward. There's going to be momentum. I would not doubt that after the 2020 elections or even in the session next year that there will be another attempt. But for the 2019 session, I would say, yes, this is the full-fledged recreational use marijuana bill is dead.
So in terms of, yeah, as you said, full-fledged marijuana legalization, probably dead. But is there, I know this wasn't the focus of the hearing today, but is there still any hope about at least decriminalizing marijuana and reducing punishments and even talking about expungement?
I would be speaking without I wouldn't really have mm-hmm. a good opinion on that because I haven't been looking into those other bills. This is a little bit off my beaten path. I am covering this bill, but typically I cover corrections and stuff like that. So no, I'm not sure. It's possible, but I wouldn't have an informed answer to that, I'm afraid.
So let's move on to another event you were at. This was last Friday, I believe, Kevin. You were present at the House debate regarding the gender equality amendment, which potentially would go on the ballot here in Minnesota in 2020. It did end up passing the House and now is going to move on to the Senate. And you and I were texting before the show. You brought up that there were some, well, interesting arguments being made against some of the Republican members against this equal rights amendment that's being proposed in Minnesota. Can you explain what that was about?
Well, there was some pretty interesting discussion about some things such as one of the prevalent arguments that I didn't expect to hear a whole lot of conversation about was what impact this would have on girls' sports. So they're saying the argument is that if this Equal Rights Amendment is passed, then that would make it give basically boys carte blanche to declare their gender to be opposite of what it was biologically at birth, and then they could go and sort of run roughshod over girls' sports tournaments, and it was a little odd, but apparently there is some precedence for this. I mean, for instance, you know, there was a tennis pro back in the 70s who changed gender and competed as a woman. This was a guy who was a man, Rene Richards, is that right? Back in the 70s. So, I mean, there's precedent for that, and in Colorado there were a couple of boys apparently I think it was Connecticut, forgive me, who competed in, I think, track and field events and broke the high school records, and that got some people bitten in a fervor.
Yeah.
Juskowski had a fascinating sort of give and take with members where he said that there are, because what this bill would do it's not equal rights amendment for women specifically. It prohibits any kind of prejudice on the basis of gender, any discrimination on the basis of gender. And they argued over that word gender just forever. And one of the things that Representative Drazkowski argued was that there are 112 different definitions of gender. So he was throwing out questions to other members on the floor. Do you know what a fetishist is? You know, and of course they didn't. And you know, do you know what gray gender is? And his point being that we're asking members to vote for something they don't truly understand. They don't know what gender really means. They don't really know what the ramifications of all this will be. But the, you know, the response was, what this means is that there would be no discrimination against anybody.
Exactly. And as we were talking about, this would be an amendment to the Minnesota Constitution, correct? So this wouldn't necessarily need the signature of Governor Walz if it passes the Senate. But again, its prospects there are probably murky, being that the Senate chamber does have a 35-32 Republican majority.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think that there's a whole lot of hope that this is even going to be picked up in the Senate.
So I want to move on to a bill that we were talking about today, and this one I think is something that could fly under the radar but could have a major impact on the criminal justice system. And this is something that's making its way through the legislature, a bill proposed by Representative Carlos Mariani, which is a bill that would revive the state parole board, which was actually abolished here in Minnesota in 1982 because the system was rife with contradictions, inefficiencies, and inconsistencies, according to a news report from 1982. Now, I'm not an expert on criminal justice, but how does the system work now compared to when we actually had a parole board? Because I did a little research, and it looks like we have something called the State Board of Pardons, which is made up of the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court, and the board looks like they hold 2 meetings a year. Is the system we have now with the Board of Pardons different from what we had with the actual State Board of Parole in 1982 and prior?
Yeah, that's an entirely different system. That's sort of the difference between basically the parole, the release of a life, somebody who's experienced on a life sentence, and basically clemency. I sat through a Board of Pardons meeting. One of the most fascinating things you'll ever do is sitting through one of those. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily involve the severity of crimes. What I saw mostly happening last year was Dayton's, one of his last acts in office. People would approach the Board of Pardons, the Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, the Attorney General, and the Governor, and they would ask for forgiveness for past crimes. Usually these are people that have already served their time. They're already out in the community. They've restarted their careers, but they've run into all kinds of roadblocks because of what it means to still have a serious felony on their record. And so they would, you know, ask for forgiveness, and they would either be given or not, and that would be it. And if it's not given, you know, too bad, so sad. But if it is, then, you know, this is expunged from their record, and they can go about their business and maybe, you know, do more to get housing and succeed in their careers. This is strictly about people serving life sentences with the possibility of parole. There are life sentences in Minnesota without the possibility of parole, and those wouldn't be affected by this. But for those people who have already served their minimum 30-year sentence of a life term, mm-hmm. Right now the only thing they can do is go to the corrections commissioner, and the corrections commissioner alone makes that determination. Of course, you know, he relies on his staff, but I've talked to Paul Schnell, the corrections commissioner here, and he wants to change this. This is really his initiative. Carlos Mariani is moving the bill, but this is really Paul Schnell first broached this a couple of weeks ago at a Sentencing Guidelines Commission meeting, and he said he wants to change this because he doesn't think it does justice to have one individual making such, you know, momentous decisions. He thinks it should be the job of a pardons board, a parole board. They actually have a different name. It's got a wonky name. Indeterminate Sentence Release Board is what they would actually call it, but it's the same thing as a parole board. But the pushback, I just talked to Warren Limmer about this. I'm sort of scooping myself here because I haven't written this. It's not in my paper yet. But I just talked to Warren Limmer about this, the judiciary chair who would have to approve this on the Senate side, and he seems to have very little interest in this. He thinks that parole boards are just as you described them. They have bad results, and what this would really do is it would alleviate a government official's responsibility.
he thinks that the responsibility rightly belongs to that one government official.
Well, what's interesting about this, too, is that Representative Nick Zerwas, he's a Republican, actually offered a counterproposal which would still allow the recreation of the parole board, but it would actually grant veto power to the governor, which, to me, that's rife from with all sorts of political problems. If you have a governor, you know, just citing an example, running for re-election and they're maybe down in the polls and they want to appear tough on crime, that just seems to me, this is my opinion, I know you're obviously an independent journalist, that we could be running into all sorts of issues here if we were to still create this board but then give veto power to a governor who obviously is a political figure.
Well, that's certainly an argument that could be made. And I think I maybe overstated by calling it a counterproposal. I think, yeah, it is that. But what it really was he was asking whether Mariani might be amenable to putting that into his bill. Mariani wasn't interested. So it didn't get into the bill. But, yeah, I mean, it would basically – what it essentially would do is would be to substitute the governor for the corrections commissioner as being the final arbiter. I mean, of course, he would have expert input from the board, because the board would exist. But in that event, if the governor didn't like the result that the board came up with, he could just turn it around and say no. And of course, that would be a very political decision. But you can also argue that it's already a political decision, because the corrections commissioner already serves at the pleasure of the governor. And if he were to do something the governor truly didn't like, you know, it could conceivably cost him his job, and that could be that could include putting somebody on parole who the governor thinks shouldn't be on parole. And I would guess there's probably political pressure against really rewarding, you know, awarding parole to a whole lot of prisoners now. I mean, I don't know that for certain. I haven't explored that with Commissioner Schnell, but it's certainly not difficult to imagine.
So what's the next step for this bill? Does it have any hope of getting through the House and then talking about its prospect on the Senate? What's next for this bill?
Well, I think it doesn't have a Senate companion yet. I was going to actually check my fact on that. Of course, as you know, I'm fresh from that committee hearing, and I was racing to try to prepare for this. I don't think I looked it up to see if there's a companion bill, but as I recall, there's not. And they only have until March. Well, they have until late March. I think it's the 30th. The second deadline, it's kind of a Byzantine system they have here. They have three deadlines. The first one is for the bill to pass out of its house of origin. Well, this one wasn't given a vote. It was laid over for inclusion in an omnibus bill. So it's going to be in the package that goes to the Senate when they present their own corrections and judiciary and public safety omnibus bill, and they'll negotiate it. So it's going to be included in those negotiations. But as far as I know, there is nothing going on in the Senate. And I think it doesn't, in that case, because of the weird way this works with these omnibus bills, it may not need to happen, because it's embedded in the larger bill. It's going to be presented for negotiations. I hope all that makes sense. It is confusing.
Yeah, it certainly sounds complicated, but yeah, as you said, it sounds like there's a chance it could be in the some sort of omnibus bill, probably not the same type we saw during the last legislative session. So maybe
a miniature version of this. Yeah. What we're going to see different this year than last year is we're going to see a whole bunch of sort of mini omnibuses. Mm-hmm. But by mini, you know, we're talking about, you know, the Appalachians as opposed to maybe Mount Everest, you know. They're still going to be very, very big bills. But they're not going to be titanic. They're just going to be a whole bunch of moderately very large bills from a whole bunch of budget sections.
That's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. It's something I'm going to follow, because it interests me, because I like to see this in the hands of people who are familiar with the cases when it comes to these parole boards, and it seems like that would be restored under this bill, but we'll have to see what happens. Kevin Featherly, we are unfortunately out of time. We got to hit a commercial break, and I know you got to run to, I think, another hearing, so I'm going to let you go as well. But thanks so much for joining us on the program today. We got to chat more, Kevin.
Thanks, Brad. It's good doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's Kevin Featherly of Min Lawyer. He is their Capitol reporter.